May it please the court. My reading of relevant past case law shows that if the trial court fails to follow the mandatory procedures of Section 558.021, prejudice and even manifest injustice can result if the finding of the defendant's status subjects him to a higher maximum sentence than he would have otherwise been eligible for. And I get that from Starnes in the West, Wilson in the East, and this court's opinions of Collins and Teer. Those are all discussed in the briefs. Now the question in this case, because obviously there's no increased maximum, Mr. Johnson was convicted of several Class A felonies, which have a mandatory minimum of 10-year sentence, but then a maximum of a term of years of 30, but then also life is available. So there can be no greater maximum than life. So the question is whether also prejudice or manifest injustice results when the mandatory minimum sentence increases. And here the mandatory minimum sentence went from 10 years all the way to life in prison. I think this question is answered by two different cases. The first is Alain v. United States, a 2013 case from the United States Supreme Court, and the other is State v. Troya, a case from the Missouri Court of Appeals Western District, also from 2013. Now, obviously, these cases are different and answer different questions than the present case. But the mandatory minimum sentence and increasing was the subject of both of those cases. In Alain, the United States Supreme Court determined that their decision in Apprendi applied when the mandatory minimum increased and not just when the maximum sentence increased. And the Supreme Court stated, there is no basis in principle or logic to distinguish the facts that raise the maximum from those that increase the minimum. I think that applies in the present case. If it's plain error when the maximum sentence increases, it's also plain error when the minimum sentence increases. In State v. Troya, the trial court was under the impression that a persistent offender status increased both the minimum and maximum punishment, and he was wrong. It increases only the maximum. The minimum remains the same. The Western District determined that misunderstanding of the law constituted plain error, that the trial judge might have wanted to give less than what he believed was the mandatory minimum. The judge believed it was 10 years when it was actually just 5 for a Class B felony. And so if plain error resulted from that misunderstanding, then plain error also resulted here when the finding was late and Mr. Johnson should not have been found to have been a predatory sexual offender. Now, as to the timing requirements, this court determined in State v. Teer that it is a mandatory requirement, 558.021. This court stated it imposes a mandate requiring that prior offender status be pleaded and proven prior to the case being submitted to the jury. This court also determined that Section 558.021 implicates a defendant's liberty and that the statute must therefore be construed strictly against the state and in favor of the defendant. And I have one last thing to say on this point, and that's the question of the trial court statements. The state has argued that initially, before deliberation, the trial court had determined the statute just didn't apply to Mr. Johnson. And that's true. That was part of the basis for the trial court's decision. But the trial court also stated, I don't see how I can make this finding prior to a determination by the jury, if one is made, that he has committed these acts that he is alleged to have committed. So my argument there is a manifest injustice has resulted based on the trial court not following 558.021, because at the time the trial court was supposed to make a finding, the trial court was unwilling to make that finding.
And is that how you address the state's argument there was no prejudice because the jury did make these findings and the trial court relied on those, and so no harm, no foul in these facts?
I think that interprets the statute in favor of the state and not in favor of the defendant. So
is there a presumption that should be established in favor of the defendant versus the state?
Yes, this court determined in State v. Tier that the statute must be construed strictly against the state and in favor of the defendant.
Well, is the requirement that in the statute that the determination be made prior to submission of the case to the jury, does that also indicate that the trial court, that the statute could not have intended the trial court to rely on the jury's findings or on the present charges because it said you have to do it before we decide if he's guilty or she's guilty of these charges?
I think that's right. The statute says it has to be made prior to deliberation, so the judge saying I'm going to rely on the jury's findings is in conflict with the plain language of the statute.
But wasn't the judge kind of in between a rock and a hard spot here? Because if he had lied upon the statute, wouldn't that have been a constitutional violation of Elaine?
I agree with that, yes.
Well, it's not a rock and a hard place if you just can't consider current charges. You have to consider other things that are permitted under the statute and the Constitution.
I think that would be a reasonable interpretation, and that goes to point two. But in point one, 558.021 says what it says. So this court can't rewrite that statute. So if
it does say on its face that you can consider charges, so the trial court could have done that, but then Eileen says you can't do that. So, and that's the rock and hard place, but
yes.
But the trial, it's not. Does that just mean you can't consider these things unless they were the subject of prior jury findings?
I think so. And I think so. In point one, I have stated it's plain error that the judge didn't follow 558.021. In point two, I've argued this court should interpret 558.018, the predatory sexual offender law, in a way that doesn't include the current charges. And those are two separate points.
Well, but you have to admit the 558.018 includes more than just prior convictions, mm-hmm. right?
I would, yes.
So what's not a prior conviction and not the current charges? Just some other uncharged conduct, right?
It would be another uncharged conduct.
So where does Elaine come in?
And actually, and I know in my brief I have stated this court should interpret it 558.018 in a way that would not conflict with Elaine. I actually, upon further reflection, I don't think 558.018 can be squared with Elaine. That it's always some kind of prior conduct that the judge would have to make, and that would violate, I'm saying Elaine, it would really violate Apprendi. So I'm actually not sure 558.018 can be squared with Elaine. Now, obviously, I haven't raised a constitutional challenge because that was not raised below. But whether or not 558.018 would be subject to a constitutional attack shouldn't have any bearing on the first point of whether there was manifest injustice that the trial court failed to follow 558.021. I will say on point two, what should the interpretation of 558.018 be? And I've argued that it should not include the current charges. And the state has argued that under subsection 558.018.5 sub 3, and that's the subsection at issue here, that it can include current charges. And I agree that you can read that reasonably to include current charges. But I've also said it doesn't plainly say that. You do have to go to interpretation to get there. And it isn't clear that current charges can be included, and when there's doubt, you should go with in favor of the defendant.
Or you should go with the constitutional reading.
I think so. You should go with the constitutional reading. And if this court
to read this statute in accordance with what you think the Constitution would require, would it basically be severing references to anything that didn't already result in a conviction?
Yes. Yes, it would.
And you could, theoretically, there could have been a waiver of jury trial.
Yes.
Conviction. Either conviction after jury trial or conviction after waiver of jury trial.
I think so. But yes. But here, it would have to really be a conviction to comply with Apprendi and Elaine. And these, especially the current charges, would not work. And if you think about it, the current charges, how troubling that is for a trial court in a jury trial to follow 558.021 and make a finding that he believes or she believes the defendant is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt of these offenses, and then preside over closing argument, and then preside over deliberation where the jury's asking questions, and then ruling on the motion for new trial, that would be a troubling way.
What the state could do is the state could charge these separately, could charge later dates.
They could.
And could easily avoid all these issues by trying four or so and then trying four or so, right?
Yes, and that certainly is not unheard of, and that's an easy fix that the state is already capable of doing.
Or couldn't the statute simply be revised to say the court makes its findings after the jury?
Yes, the statute, there is nothing written in stone with this statute. I mean, this court has to follow, but the legislature could easily amend this statute. If there are no further questions, thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome back, Ms. Craver.
Well, thank you, Judge Kevin.
It's
been a while.
It has.
I really can't remember the last time I've been up here. May it please the court, Karen Kramer for the respondent, State of Missouri. I'd like to begin by talking about the threshold issue, which is whether Mr. Johnson here was a predatory sexual offender, because if this court doesn't find that he falls within the definition in the statute, really beside the point at what time the finding was made. We charged him under Section 3 of 558.018.5, Paragraph 3, which says that a predatory sexual offender is a person who has committed an act or acts against more than one victim, which would constitute an offense or offenses listed in Subsection 4. There's no issue about that. Whether or not the defendant was charged with an additional offense or offenses as a result of such act or acts. He fits that definition. He did commit acts against more than one victim. We proved that. The acts that he committed did constitute offenses that fall within this. It doesn't matter whether he was charged or not. As it happens in this case, he was charged. And so he meets the statutory definition. Now, appellant's argument that he doesn't meet the statutory definition, and this was the argument that was raised at trial, and I think this is the argument that confused the trial court as to how this statute applies, is they were arguing it has to be a prior offense. It has to be a previously committed act. But that's covered under paragraph 2. And if the court had wanted paragraph 3 to have to be a previously committed act, an act committed previous to the ones that he's on trial for, they could have put that in there. If we read previously into that section, then we're essentially making paragraph 2 a nullity. And that is not, that's not proper statutory interpretation.
But doesn't the determination of whether or not he is qualified or he is a sexually violent predator under number 3, mm-hmm. Isn't that determination made prior to the submission to the jury? And if it is made and the court does find he is, and then the jury later acquits him of that charge, then where are we?
Well, that's a different question, Your Honor, and it's a problem. I will admit it's a problem. We get questions. I mean, since Elaine? Is that how you say it? Okay, I never know if it's Elaine or Elaine. Since Elaine came down, we get questions all the time from prosecutors. How are we supposed to do this? Because we've got a statute here that says this has to be found before, and we've got a U.S. Supreme Court case that says because. And let's be very clear, this is only talking about the predatory sexual offender status. The other prior offender statuses, to my knowledge, are not affected by this. But the predatory sexual offender status is because it increases the minimum punishment. And so under Elaine, that actually has to be found by a jury. So what do you do? I think what happened in this case, was it the best way to do it? Might not have been the best way to do it. Obviously, we did not comply with the timing statute. I can't stand here and say that we did. No way. But that's not the whole issue. The issue is whether there was plain error or not.
Well, and plainly, it was in violation of the statute. And the prejudice
yes.
is that now you get to rely on a jury finding that under the statute you're not entitled to.
But under the United States Supreme Court, you are required to.
I understand. But so you can't. I mean, the prejudice is, had you done it the way the statute requires, you would not have been able to rely on these charges because the Constitution does not permit it.
See, I disagree, Your Honor, because I think what we're looking at when we're trying to determine whether there's been plain error or not is whether the defendant has been given as much due process as he's required under the Constitution, if I may. And Elaine has said that when you're increasing the minimum statute, when you're increasing the minimum punishment, you have to give that. That is an element. It's not just a sentencing. It's an element. And so that has to go to the jury. And so here we have a situation, and I'm specifically talking about this case here. I can't say for sure. I don't know that this court can. I honestly don't. Maybe you can. You're a better man than I, better men and women than I if you can. But to solve for the future what this is going to be, my issue standing before the court today is, what do we do about this case?
Well, what Potter Stewart said,
since the judge did not make the finding
initially,
the statute clearly says it has to be before. I mean, you can seek. Why couldn't you seek a writ? Say, judge, the statute says you have to make this finding. I mean, just because you asked the judge to, what are you going to do if the judge says, I am not prepared to make that finding. I'm not going to make that finding, and I think that the Constitution requires a jury to make that finding. So I'm not going to do it.
That's the problem that our prosecutors face. I don't know what would happen if we came up with the
remedy. The remedy is, if you want to enhance, you can charge them separately, right? If you really want to enhance the mandatory minimum, you can have two trials.
Yeah, that's a way to do it. I'm not saying you couldn't do that, Your Honor.
Why is it a problem to comply with both the Constitution and the statute? You can only comply with the parts that appear on the legislature when they wrote this, didn't have the benefit of Elaine. I'm not sure how to pronounce it either.
Either.
But now they do, and now we do, and we need to interpret it constitutionally. I don't understand the dilemma of not, if you don't try to use the current charges, you don't have a problem in applying the statute.
Well, and again, Your Honor, I don't argue with the fact that there may be ways to do this. I don't. I'm not here to do that. I'm here to talk about whether there was plain error in this case and what was the defendant deprived of that resulted in a manifest injustice or miscarriage of justice in this case.
And can you please answer, Ms. Kramer, if the judge had followed the statute, could this person have been found to be a predatory sexual offender prior to submission of this case to the jury? Because that's what the trial court should have done, is decided this prior to the case going to the jury. And if he'd followed the statute or she'd followed the statute, would they have been able to consider these other charges?
Yes, they could have. Absolutely, they could have. If I'm understanding your question,
And following the Constitution. Had they done it right, why isn't it prejudicial? Because they considered things that, had they done it correctly under the statute and the Constitution, they could not have considered. How can that not be prejudicial, that they will consider what the jury did here, where if they correctly followed the law, they could not?
Your Honor, it's not prejudicial because, number one, the jury did consider them, which is exactly the due process that the U.S. Supreme Court says he's entitled to. So he can't complain that a jury found the predicate facts that were needed to find. So the question then, now, the judge could have made that finding. The judge didn't make that finding because the judge made a mistake of law, and because the judge was misinterpreting the statute. The judge certainly could have considered those charges, could have considered that, could have considered all of the evidence that was before it in making that finding. It was perfectly within.
Absent a waiver of jury?
Pardon?
Absent a waiver of the jury trial on that issue?
Yes. On that issue, yes. I mean, under the statute, yes. And they could have. And they also could have submitted it to the jury. But what I'm saying is, he got both. He got the jury, he got the judge to consider it, he got the jury to consider it. They just didn't do it in the time frame. Well, what is the harm from the time frame? That it didn't happen under that time. Remember, he waived jury sentencing before they even heard a bit of evidence. He waived jury sentencing. So this isn't a situation where he would have had jury sentencing if you had done this. This isn't like Tier, Where what happened in Teer, which, you know, that, I worked on that case. That was my case, and that was about 9 years ago. Anyway, I worked on Teer. And in Teer, what happened was the prosecutor, again, tried to do it correctly, went to the judge and said, hey, judge, before we submit this to the jury, we need to prove him up as a prior and persistent. And the judge says, oh, I just want to get this to the jury. Let's just get it to the jury, and then we'll take care of it. So that's what they did. Well, when they sent it to the jury, of course, back then, the instructions, they all had the penalties on there, too. So the jury came back with a penalty, 4 years. And then the judge says, oh, no, I find him to be a prior persistent offender, 20 years. There was prejudice found in that case because he lost a jury sentence, a very generous jury sentence, I might add, in that case. The defendant in this case hasn't lost anything. The only thing he lost was the fact that the judge had initially made an incorrect interpretation of the statute in thinking, I can't figure this out now because no jury has found these facts, and I don't think he falls under this statute. Well, he doesn't have a due process right to a mistake of law.
Well, it's only a mistake if you think the statute entitles you to consider the current charges. And that brings up a question Judge Russell asked earlier, which I don't believe was based on the Constitution, but based on the statute.
I'm sorry.
If you're correct in interpreting the statute to allow the judge to decide before he submits to the issue to the jury, what he would find, if he were the fact finder, or she would find if she were the fact finder, then you run the risk of conflicting decisions. What if the judge finds that you failed to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, but the jury finds you did, or vice versa, as Judge Russell asked, what if the jury acquits after the judge has found you have proven it beyond a reasonable doubt? Does it make sense to interpret the statute as allowing use of current charges and therefore creating that inherent potential conflict, which wouldn't exist if it wasn't dealing with the ones you're actually about to submit to the jury, to have the judge for some reason decide them first?
And I understand that, Your Honor, and here's what I think about. If, for example, which of course is not what happened here, but if, for example, we had, let's say the judge had made a finding ahead of time under the statute, made a timely finding, and said, yes, I think he's a predatory sexual offender, and they send it to the jury, and the jury acquits him, then I think the jury's ruling stands. First of all, he's been acquitted, so he's not going to be sentenced anyway.
Well, you could have two charges, and they acquit of one and find guilty on the other. So it could
right, but it depends on how he's been charged, Your Honor. It depends on what he's been charged with. But I think that's one way that happens. But we don't have that in this case. Now, I understand this court's probably trying to figure out how are we supposed to fix this for the future. Honestly, I think the best way to fix it is a legislative fix. But
why couldn't we say that both are required, that the statute requires the judge to find it and the Constitution requires the jury to find it, and they have to happen in that order?
I think you could do that. I have no problem with the court saying you have to do that. And honestly, you know, I mean, I think we're looking for guidance as to exactly how they're supposed to work this out. All I'm saying, again, not to beat a dead horse, but under the facts in this case, I don't think that there's a manifest injustice or miscarriage of justice where you have both the judge and the jury finding him to be a predatory sexual offender where he had already waived jury sentencing. There's no argument that he's not a predatory sexual offender. He's not contending that he's not. All he's arguing about is this time element. Well, this time element isn't it's not structural error. It's not a structural error where they don't have to actually show prejudice. And I just, under these circumstances, you bring up hypotheticals, and they're very valid hypotheticals, and they are, you know, they may come up, and we do need to know how to address them. I agree. I wholly agree. But those aren't the facts in this case, and so in deciding this case and what should be done with Mr. Johnson, I think there was no manifest injustice or miscarriage of justice. Was there an error? Yes, there was an error. Absolutely. But there wasn't a manifest injustice where he waived jury sentencing and both the judge and the jury found him to be a predatory sexual offender. Unless there are any other questions or comments or hypotheticals for me or anything else?
Anything else? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So does waiving the jury change the status of this case, dealing with this case in particular? Does waiving the jury change the case at all for you?
No. I believe the defendants in Starnes and Wilson both waived the jury sentencing.
But clearly, so, Tier wouldn't apply.
Well, that specific aspect of Tier would not apply. But certainly the language from Tier that 558021 imposes a mandate, that would apply. Certainly Tier's finding that the statute must be construed strictly against the state and in favor of the defendant, that would apply. And the state is seemingly trying to relitigate those findings in Tier. And the state has also argued that Mr. Johnson got all of the due process he was entitled to, but due process has two components. It has constitutional requirements, and even assuming he got those, it also has a statutory component. And based on the language in Tier, Mr. Johnson did not receive due process based on the court not following Section 558021.
How's your client offended by the construction I'm positing, that we say the statute requires the judge to find it and the Constitution requires the jury to find it, and they happen in that order, so the trial judge isn't influenced by the jury's decision?
Well, so that doesn't apply to this case because the trial court did not follow that order, so that's the first step.
Well, but everyone's conceding error, so the,
yes.
But if that's the construction of the statute, would your client be offended by it?
So he would be offended in the sense that in point two, I've argued you should not be able to use current charges just based on a statutory analysis. So assuming I'm wrong on the statutory.
Can you address that for us, why you think that's the proper statutory analysis? Because Judge Wilson's saying you could interpret the statute to say you do both those things in that order, and you disagree in point two. Can you summarize that?
In point two, subsection three, it uses that word has, so it's at least past tense, and I agree subsection two says has previously, and so there's the question, is subsection three referring to any charge, including the current charges, and I do not believe subsection three is clear enough that this court should assume that's what the legislature meant. That would be an extraordinary thing, and I'm not sure of any other statutes that are unclear about current charge being interpreted for a higher sentence or a higher mandatory minimum. Has previously could refer to before certain charges, and has could just refer to even after the current charges. It would be one reasonable way to interpret that. But essentially, my argument is that it's not clear either way, and this court should read it in favor of the defendant. But Judge Wilson, assuming I'm wrong on that, I don't know that that would be a bad approach, that having the judge making a finding of predatory and then the jury constitutionally. I do think it would be a problem having the judge actually stating, I believe the defendant is guilty, and then presiding over closing argument and deliberations and the motion for new trial. That would be my only concern.
Thank you. The case will be submitted.